Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can people with visual impairments experience the transformative joys of visual art as spectators or even as creators? My guests today are both interested in that question, and in their own way, each has helped to demonstrate that art can be deeply satisfying for those who rely on senses other than sight to navigate the world around them. Carmen Smith is Director of Education at the Meadows Museum. John Bramblett is an artist who will present demonstrations of his painting by touch techniques this Saturday when the Meadows holds a Family Day event. There will also be opportunities for visitors to experience artworks through movement, taste, touch, sound, and smell. Welcome both of you to Think.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Carmen, we'll start with you. How did serving differently abled patrons become a focus for the Meadows Museum?
Well, actually about 3 years ago, we started considering ways to reach out to different audiences, to expand and diversify our audiences. And so we looked at what our colleagues were doing in the area and piloted our first program, which was designed specifically for individuals with early stage dementia. And then in the process of developing these techniques and approaches, we started to consider whether or not those approaches had more universal applications. So we then considered, well, gee, would this be good for audiences who were visually impaired, blind and low vision audiences, or what other audiences with cognitive or physical disabilities? And so we started piloting them and experimenting and doing working with focus groups, and then we started to understand the broader, even broader implications, which is that a lot of the techniques and approaches we were using actually were of interest to our general audiences. So that's the kind of the way we took it. We started thinking less about access programs for targeted groups and more for programs that were inclusive of all audiences.
And it turns out that there was a real hunger for this.
Absolutely. When we had our focus groups come in, we worked with a number of focus groups, and we actually worked with Marianne Siller, who is the National Consultant for Blindness and Low Vision, and she helped us connect with people in our community who were blind or had low vision, and we started working with John. And in so doing, we started to discover that a lot of people that had visual impairment either were not born blind, or it never occurred to them to come to a museum because they were born blind.
Right.
So if they weren't born blind, they had a history of visiting museums, they thought all of a sudden that part of their world was shut out to them, that no longer could visit and appreciate a visual art experience. And so we started asking a lot of questions, and with John's help, we were able to connect with and try to figure out ways to serve these audiences.
So, John, you had always you'd always engaged with art. You drew all the time. I was fascinated to learn that you really didn't paint until after you had fully lost your sight.
No, I didn't. I always drew, and it was always black and white sort of drawings or grayscale kind of things. And I would write. So I would do a drawing, and then I would write about it. But it wasn't until I couldn't see color anymore that I really wanted to make sure that I could keep color back in my life in somehow. It sounds a little crazy, but I was a little afraid that I would forget what colors looked like, you know, what the color red looked like or blue. But so I wanted to get it back into my life somehow. But
Can you talk about how you began to explore the possibility that you could actually paint things? Because you had to look at materials that would work for you.
Yes, and I must say that when I first started, I was pretty sure I was crazy. I thought I'd finally lost my mind. I thought, this is it, John. They're going to come after you with the butterfly nets. But because the idea of a visually impaired person painting just didn't seem, you know, like something that you could do. But I was using my sense of touch to do everything else, like to get around town, to understand where I was, to understand where everything was around me. And I thought, well, if I can do that, and if I could walk down a street, then surely I could use these same techniques that, you know, using the white cane, and now with my guide dog Echo, use the same techniques to find my way around a canvas. And so I would use lines to work as landmarks. Mm-hmm. I would draw, and it was more like making a topographic map. And when I was sighted, I could make very detailed sort of drawings, you know, portraits, exploded views of engines, all these sorts of things that are very detailed. When I first lost my eyesight and I was trying to get back into it, I was trying to draw things like squares or circles and trying to make it match what I was feeling to the square that I had in my mind, and just trying to get the two to link up. Mm-hmm. And But whenever I made my very first drawing, I was so excited because then I knew it was possible. And the wonderful thing about art is that it's all about what you can do. So if you can do something, then you can work on it and you can make it better.
I guess when you don't have your sight to get through sort of everyday life and move about the world, spatial relations ironically becomes more important than anything else.
It does. You tend to walk into things quite a bit. And I know the first couple of years I had a lot of bruises and cuts and you learn the hard way, or you know, and then you start learning it. Here's the wonderful thing about art and about painting is that it forces you to understand the physical relationship between things and the spatial relationship. And it's a lot easier to draw a line on a canvas and get that right than it is to remember a room or where a chair is. You know, if you mess up on the canvas, you're not going to get a bruise on your knee or anything. But the wonderful thing is that you're practicing the same skills though. So it's called O&M, or orientation and mobility training, mm-hmm. pardon me, and using the white cane or just knowing where things are. So I use the same sort of skills like with the white cane on the canvas. So the more I paint, the better it gets.
So for people who haven't seen your work, and you do have a great website online, they can check it out, but you are not doing abstract stuff here. You are doing landscapes and portraits and still lives.
That's right. I you know, the reason I started painting, really, it was to reconnect with people. And like I say, at first I thought I was crazy, but it was, you know, having a disability, depression is a very common sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely depressed with the loss of vision, and I have epilepsy. So I had all these different things going along, and getting into painting was my way of dealing with that. But it's amazing doing that because it forces you into a mindset where you're not worried about the things you've lost. You're not thinking about the things that you can't do anymore. You're not concerned about the future and the plans that you might not be able to do. You're only thinking about that brushstroke to brushstroke, you know, that little bit of paint you have on the brush. It forces you to live in the moment, and that changes the way that you think. Hmm. You know, you start appreciating, you know, what it is you're doing. And so thank goodness for art, and oh my word.
Carmen, what have you and your colleagues learned about the best ways to serve people with lots of different sort of sensory needs by just watching people as they come in and checking their reaction and asking them about how their experience went?
Well, it's interesting because very often when we train our docents, we always say, and our docents are our volunteers who are up guide people's experiences through the museums. And very often we say to them that everybody comes through the door with a different set of experiences, interests. And so when we work with individuals with disabilities, those interests and abilities become very apparent to mm-hmm. us. So we try very hard to make sure that we're giving people lots of different contexts or ways to approach works of art. So whether it be connecting through art or through music or literature, or affording people lots of different ways to approach the work and to connect to things in their own experience, and also to afford visitors opportunities to have a multisensory experience. In other words, to connect through using all of their senses, either through imagination, so mm-hmm. to imagine what this might smell like or taste like, or so inviting them to engage all of their senses is a great way to democratize the whole experience, because it's really an opportunity for people to engage through multiple perspectives and in multiple contexts. And so by watching the average visitor, if you really engage in a conversation with them, then you can begin to understand what their areas of interest are. And everybody's there for very different reasons. And frankly, a lot of people like to share their experience and thoughts about works of art. So having conversations about works of art is really valuable. And we're trying to be more conversational in our approaches.
I'd love for both of you to answer this. The question of how to describe a work of art to someone who is not able to see it visually. Is it different when you are describing that work for someone who has no way to sort of picture it? In other words, they can picture it in their minds, but they can't see it. Is that a different kind of description than the standard one that you might put next to a work in a museum?
What's interesting is describing a work of art to someone who has never seen. If you describe it in the same way to someone who has seen, it makes the experience better for everyone. It's mm-hmm. interesting. So at the Meadows, one of the wonderful things is that there's so many, I don't know what the word for it, but other other things to relate to the art. So if you know, if there's a recreation of the painting, a lot of times you can touch. So in a museum, you're not allowed to touch the painting, right. But there's recreations where you can actually feel the brush strokes. Mm-hmm. And whether you're sighted or not, that's so great to feel. It's so wonderful. You're getting hands-on. You're connecting. There's smells that you can smell. Like if there's grass in the artwork. And that may sound a little odd, like, you know, having a sense that you're smelling there in the galleries, but it activates different parts of your brain. It makes ideas come up. It's just incredible how it just stimulates the ideas, the sounds, and plus just the verbal description of the painting. And it seems to help to have a conversation, you know, if you describe the painting, but then, and, you know, and you hear what the person, the viewers, what their thoughts of it are. And, you know, it just makes a dialogue. And the whole idea for a museum, of course, is to connect with the artwork.
Yeah, I mean, description is traditionally with visitors, we might describe things, but more in terms of we leap to interpretation. We try very hard to go, what does this work mean? And we ask what's going on in the work. But we don't very often with our general audiences just have an opportunity to just talk about what they see.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually when we describe, then we just attend to those things that might be less obvious. But when you're working with individuals who are blind or have low vision, what you need to do is give them opportunities to derive their own interpretation. And the only way you can do that is if you are giving them the most objective description you can about the work. And also describing the surroundings, because the museum context itself is very important. What other works are on view around the work, because these works have a dialogue with each other in the galleries, and they will affect our perception and interpretation of the works as well. So it's important that when we give descriptions that we give everybody, that's individuals of all abilities, those with sight, without, opportunities to really process what's in front of them, share the space with the work, understand the object, mm-hmm. and then give them opportunities to talk about what it means to them.
The idea of describing completely objectively is very interesting, and it seems like quite a challenge. I really like art. I don't know very much about it, so I'm always interested in what the experts have to say. Sometimes I will look at something like a portrait, and an expert has said, this person looks languid and depressed, and I'll think, gosh, I thought that person looked placid, but an expert says that they look languid and depressed. So how would you sort of describe an expression like that that might in fact be open to interpretation among people who could see?
Well, that's the real beauty of working with mixed abilities groups, as John can attest. I mean, because when we have what we'll do is we'll try to give it an objective description. So we might describe a face as, you know, well, I, you know, the mouth is somewhat downturned. Mm-hmm. You know, it could, to me, it might convey a sense of sadness. What do others of you think? And those that are sighted can contribute their interpretations. In fact, just yesterday in the galleries, we were working with a group of seniors, and we were asking them to use adjectives to describe the qualities of the water. We were looking at a number of Sorolla paintings, and there were beach scenes. And the descriptions were so different. They were so different. Mm. Some said deep, some said shallow, some said very calm, others said agitated. And so that it's that dialogue and the diversity of interpretations that makes the conversation so rich, and through which we learn so much.
We're speaking this hour with Carmen Smith, who is Director of Education at the Meadows Museum on the SMU campus, and artist John Bramblett, who has been completely blind since 2001 and continues to paint. The Meadows Museum is holding a Family Day event this Saturday, which will include opportunities to experience artworks through many different senses, including sight, but not limited to sight. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are painter John Bramlett, who has been painting since 2000, who has been completely blind since 2001, but has been painting from just after that time. Also, Carmen Smith is here. She is director of education at the Meadows Museum. The Meadows is holding a family day event this Saturday, which will include opportunities to experience artworks through multiple senses. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or email think at kera.org. So, John, I was thinking about your work and your career, and the sort of corollary is someone like Beethoven, who continued to compose music after he could no longer hear the music. And there are a lot of people who say, who hear that and think, isn't that sad? And they might think about you in that capacity that you can't see these works that you're creating. First of all, I don't get the sense that you feel that way. And I don't get the sense that you feel like you're missing anything because the works exist in your head.
I'm a happier person now than I've ever been in my life. If I could go back in time and regain my vision, but somehow keep everything that I've learned, then I would do that. But if I could go back and regain my vision, but not keep everything I learned, I wouldn't. I've learned so much, and it's affected my artwork. It's made my artwork much better. Before I was sighted, I would try to draw something, and if it was realistic, if it looked like the thing, then I was happy with it. But and after I lost my eyesight, trying to reconnect with people was important for me to try and make whatever I was going to paint look like the person. Because I wanted people to understand that I'm still me in here. I can still understand the world and relate.
Yeah.
But that wasn't enough. It needed to portray who that person was and the way they felt and the way I felt about them or the music that they're playing. Like I love to paint musicians and I'll paint the way they look, but then the music that they create, I see color when I hear music, so I put that color into the paintings, and that's not something that I could have done when I was sighted. I mean, I could have done, but I would never have thought about it. I never would have pushed my art in that direction.
So you see color when you hear music. Synesthesia?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And how does that affect the way you work now?
You know, it affects my whole life. Even being in here when we first started talking, the walls to me were more of a gray, and they've gotten warmer and more and more colorful. And, you know, it's so my life, it's weird. Art reflects life and life reflects art. So my world is a very bizarrely colored place anymore. Whenever somebody talks or hear a bird call, it changes the way the environment looks for me. And I'm always touching stuff. I'm always touching, and everything I touch, I'm visualizing, I'm trying to understand. So it just forms my world. And the more I paint, the better it gets, and vice versa.
How do you assess a work when it's complete?
I paint a painting in my mind before I start it. Mm-hmm. So every brush stroke, every layer, and then I always change it, of course, while I'm painting. I've never not. But a painting it's a poem, it's a book, it's a story, it's expression. It's a way of sending a message to another person. And whenever I get to the point where I think one more brush stroke is gonna take away from that message, then I know I'm done. So I just keep painting until I get that feeling.
Carmen, tell us about Joaquin Sorolla y Bastida and what made him a particularly good artist to feature during this family event when you're sort of exploring all different senses.
Well, frankly, because I think John hit on a number of points. One being that John's association with color and feeling. Sorolla's works are extremely colorful, and the brushstrokes are they range from very loose and abstract to very tight in a single composition. And so there's a lot of food for thought in terms of the way he has almost expressionistic approach in some respects, his use of color and the way he conveys emotion and feeling in these landscapes and in his figures, in his portraits as well. So they're extremely rich in terms of tactily, both literally speaking, but also visually speaking, in terms of the way the implied textures and the kinds of things that he's conveying in his works. He incorporates, he's got landscapes that are rich with flowers and trees and buildings and the water and the beach scenes. There's just they're incredibly rich and easy. They're accessible on so many levels. And they hit a lot of universal themes in terms of pastimes and enjoyment. And the audiences are responding in amazing ways to them, and there's no reason why we shouldn't explore them from many different perspectives.
When you do reproductions, either of a painting or of a sculpture, so that people can touch them, by the way, I'm all for that because I want to touch everything when I go to the museum and I know I'm not supposed to. How do those get created? Is there some like digital technology, or do you hire an artist to fabricate something that is very similar?
Both, actually. Mm-hmm. We work with visual aid volunteers, and they create these or commission out, contract out, these compositional drawings, the raised line drawings of a work. So, and we started with our permanent collection. We have about, we're working on 12 raised line drawings of works in the collection. And so as we're describing the work of art, someone who is sighted or not can follow along with their fingers and understand where certain areas of the composition might have more concentration of light, or you know what, so they can navigate the canvas. As John said earlier, the way he uses his orientation mobility skills, our visitors can also follow along and use those skills to understand the composition of a painting or a three-dimensional work. Hopefully we'll get to that as well. And then we also have what are called surface studies, and those are commissioned by SMU students so far, and they are basically replicate the texture, the actual texture of the painting as much as possible.
So thick, gloppy paint,
yeah,
or slick
exactly.
paint.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And one example that's really terrific is we have a work by Diego Rivera, and it is extremely tactile, and it's heavy impasto and parts of a pipe. It's a portrait of Ilya Ehrenberg, and the pipe protrudes from the canvas. Mm. And so we replicated that, or the student did. And so when we're talking about that, again, as we're working with our audiences, they can touch it and they can understand what it feels like. So there are lots of ways. You know, in terms of touch, just even as John was speaking earlier, I was thinking about how important touch is. And we're forever quoting something that John once said, and he probably says it a lot more, but I don't know. And it is that our touch is truer than our sight.
Hmm.
And I love this whole notion that our eyes aren't always the best way to process information about something, that sometimes sight is deceiving. And so when we do have touch tours of our sculpture on the plaza, and those are scheduled visits, when we do that, it's remarkable how someone who has sighted is sitting there and having a conversation about the work, and then just by virtue of touching it, they start to see all sorts of other things and make other sorts of observations. So that touch and engaging another part of the brain, as John said earlier, that is, it enables us to have a much deeper understanding of the works of art.
John, do you want to follow up on that?
Oh, you know, one of the things about the workshop, there's so much fun. So much fun. And we just, there's laughing. We have never had a workshop that just wasn't a blast. And it's funny because a lot of the things that we were doing was to incorporate people with disabilities to be able to come and access the program. But, you know, it makes it better for everybody. And, you know, and really, if you think about a disability, we all have abilities and disabilities. Disability just means there's something you can't do. And for me, you know, a bigger disability for me is probably my inability to do my own taxes, maybe, you know, than my vision. So, you know, there's always things we can't do, and we all learn it in different ways. We mm-hmm. all use our senses in different ways. And the wonderful thing about this program is that it just engages all of your senses. And that is just, it's just brilliant. It's just so much fun to do. There's things to hear. There's people to talk to. That's one of the things I think people are most surprised at when they come to the workshop, is just how much fun it is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jane in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Hi, John. I especially want to talk with you today. I'm blind myself, and like you, I had partial vision growing up, and I also had an older sister who was an art history major, and she used to read her papers to me as she had to describe a painting, and if I could relate back to her what she was describing, then she knew that she had written a wonderful paper.
Oh,
and
that's wonderful.
She got A's. And so we used to work together on that, which was really wonderful. But now I am totally blind myself, and I still love color and believe that I remember color. Mm-hmm. And so my question for you, John, is, how did you go from appreciating your memories of art and color to developing and nurturing your talent? Where did you go? Who worked with you? How did you get started?
Well, Jane, that is a great question. And when I started there, there was nobody to work with me. Like I say, I thought I was pretty sure I was crazy, so I kept my interest in art a secret whenever I started painting. And my first couple of shows, I didn't even tell people I was blind, and the shows did well, so I just kept it a secret, and then it came out that I was blind.
But, let me interrupt for a second. Mm-hmm. You didn't tell them because you didn't want them to think, this is great for a blind guy.
Right.
Is that why?
I just wanted them to look at the artwork and just take the message of the artwork in. And people would come up after the show and say, hey, do you know where the artist is? Oh, you know, I'm interested in this painting. And I'd say, you know, I'd have my cane there. Mm-hmm. I'd say, oh, I'm the artist. And they'd always stop for a second. Like I was telling them a joke, and they're waiting for the punchline. But then, you know, and then they would always go back and relook at every one of the paintings. Mm-hmm. And I think they were trying to find the blindness in the painting. And so, but then after a story was written, it was obvious that I was blind. So I started having show openings then, you know, mm-hmm. like a normal artist mm-hmm. would. But, Jane, and I want to encourage you if you want to send me an email or I can work with you, and I can tell you what I did. And my email is bramblett@gmail.com. Or look it up online. And anybody who's visually impaired or has any questions, please don't hesitate to email me because there's not a whole lot of information out there. But there's ways of using color as texture, of having different texture for colors. There's other ways of mixing color using a recipe sort of systems. There's other ways that I've come up with that I don't use, but I've came up with them for other visually impaired artists. There is so much out there. And the biggest tip that I could give you is don't judge. If you start getting into artwork and you start painting, whenever I did it, I gave myself a year and I said, you know, I'm not going to judge what I'm doing for a year. And I'd fall in that trap and I'd start thinking like, oh, this is bad. I think, oh, I'm not allowed to. Hmm. And then a year later, you know, I could appraise. And I still do that. And I think, you know, so that's the biggest thing, because it's so easy to get discouraged, to not think that you're making the progress you need to make. But it's so rewarding, though. Oh, my goodness. It's just incredible.
Who was the first person you showed your work to after that year?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I would paint 14 to 18 hours a day every day.
Wow.
And I went to school, and my mom was actually the first person. I usually went out to dinner with my parents on a Friday, and art quickly took over my life. I thought I could keep it in a 4-foot square area, and then suddenly it was all over my two-bedroom apartment, and I started sleeping in the closet to make more room for the art.
Seriously?
Yeah. My little white dog wasn't white for long. She had paint all over her because I would forget I had paint on my hands when she'd come over. But I actually borrowed an easel from my mom. My mom painted when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and she had an old easel. And so she knew what I was up to. And I felt kind of sorry later. I told her that I was working on a painting, and they were coming over one day, and then she was going to look at it. And she said that she was so worried because she didn't want to let me down. You know, she didn't want to hurt my feelings, but she knew that the painting couldn't be good. She didn't want to lie to me either. So she had this really hard dilemma. And she came in, and bless her heart, she was so relieved. She says, "Oh, John, I actually like it." And but my mom and my dad, they're amazing people. I was sick a lot as a child, and they're, I don't know, just an amazing relationship with them. So I was so glad that she was actually happy with the painting.
I can imagine. You never stop needing your mom's approval regardless, right?
Well, this is true. Yeah. Don't tell her I said that.
Carmen, you know, some of the things that you and John have both been talking about reminds me that many times people who walk into a museum taking their sight in particular for granted kind of breeze past a lot of the works of art, which is not to say that everybody needs to stop and make a study of every single piece in a museum. But there is something about sort of compelling oneself to consider other senses that really does make it take more time and maybe just requires you to think more deeply about it than you would if you just looked at it and said, oh, that's pretty, I don't like that one, and moved on.
Right. Yeah. In fact, the program that we developed, it's titled Insights and Outlooks with John. It does focus on a single work of art. While we might look at other works, it's always in relation to that one. And so it is great because for really an hour and a half, 2 hours, we are having very interesting conversations about, you know, again, exploring the work from many perspectives and in relation to many different things and through all our senses, and giving everybody an opportunity to share their thoughts about it is terrific. And, you know, I don't think we ever run out of things to say. In fact, I feel like we always feel like, oh my gosh, our time's up. it is remarkable. I'm amazed at how often people are wanting to share their thoughts about a particular work of art. So, you know, we know that most museum visitors visit with somebody, and it tends to be a social experience. But you're right. I mean, they'll go through and they kind of elect to spend a little more time with one work depending or another depending upon what their interests are. And things call, you know, might call their attention. They'll read a label, and you know, it's the dialogue, and it's having the dialogue with the work, engaging with others, and talking about it, and again, being encouraged to think about it from many perspectives. As John said, what's interesting too is that because everybody is bringing different sets of abilities and backgrounds, we're learning from each other in a very rich way. And so, yeah, it's great when we give ourselves permission to really focus on a single work or two, and those opportunities, we don't usually give ourselves that chance. You know, you pay admission to go someplace, and you're going to try and see as much as you can.
Right, get your money's worth.
Yeah, exactly.
John, have you thought about the difference in the experience for someone like you who has memory of sight as opposed to someone who does not remember being able to see?
It is. It's very interesting. And I have to say, even after having lost my sight for a number of years, I thought, for a person, you know, that had never seen, that it must be terrible not knowing like what a chair looks like, or what these different things look like. You know, a mountain, you know, if you've never been able to feel an entire mountain, you don't really know what it looks like, and or the moon or anything that you can't really touch. But I was doing a workshop in Austin for the governor's office once, and they brought in all these families. And there was these two boys. There was one boy who was blind since birth, and another, his brother, who had perfect vision. And I was having them both do a drawing together. And they had never drawn together before. Mm. You know, it was the first time. And they were both doing their house, and their sighted brother, he did the typical sort of peaked roof house.
Right.
And the visually impaired brother, he did a floor layout of the house. Hmm. It was what you would feel, but it was interesting because it was both the house. It was just a completely different perspective. So one wasn't right, one wasn't wrong. It was just different.
John Bramblett is my guest. He is an artist. We're also here with Carmen Smith, Director of Education at the Meadows Museum. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Meadows Museum is holding a Family Day event this Saturday, which will include opportunities to experience artworks through sight, but also through movement, taste, touch, smell, and sound. We're talking today with artist John Bramblett, who will be giving a workshop there, and with Carmen Smith, who is Director of Education at the Meadows Museum. And Meadows, by the way, is located on the SMU campus in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, John, are you able to fall in love with a new work of art that you have not seen before?
Yes. Oh my goodness. I fall in love with art all the time. I go online and I read about artists, famous artists, new artists, artists that are working on new techniques. I love to go to show openings, and if the artist is there, they usually let me touch their artwork. And I think I've learned more about painting and how to control a brush and a paint knife more from feeling other artists work and how they work the paint just through touch. And I've been very fortunate in being able to feel like a Monet, a Van Gogh, a Renoir, and to be able to feel the way that they work the paint and to understand. And it's interesting, if you can ever get hands on with art, do it. You get so much more from it. And you know, if it's a short, like choppy sort of stroke, then you know the way that the artist must have been working his hand and his arm, and the way how he must have been feeling, or if it was a long, really slow, languid sort of stroke. You know, he couldn't have been too excited. So it's, you know, it's a way of just appreciating how the composition was put together.
Carmen, obviously, you know, we've talked about the sort of reproductions, and obviously museums cannot let people go up and touch a lot of the works. But sculpture is an interesting case, and I'm not arguing here for people to go up and, you know, touch pieces of bronze, but it does seem more durable. Is the thinking changing that for certain patrons, museums might be able to make opportunities for people to actually touch particular works?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, unfortunately, even though we do get this question too, you know, you've got your works on the sculpture plaza, they're exposed to the elements. Why can't I touch? But if everybody touched, it's the oils on the hands, of course. So I think as much as possible, museums are changing the way they're trying to be more accessible. They're trying very hard. And when they can, they make those allowances. In our case, what we do is every time we want to have a touch tour, we want to have invite a group. Then, you know, we wear special gloves and, you know, we navigate very carefully. And it changes. It depends upon the work and what it's been exposed to most recently. The way we get around that is a lot of times is we just try to think of, you know, creating something that replicates the work as much as possible. So, you know, if we can have, say, a reproduction of the work, obviously it wouldn't be in scale if it's a large scale work on the plaza, but at least if somebody can get their hands around it and understand a little bit the whole depart relationships in the work itself or understand the way something is moving. So we use descriptive language all the time to talk about the works of art, but there is nothing like touching it and being able to experience or touch something that replicates or gives us some way to engage that part of the brain mm-hmm. that says, yes, this is what it feels like, or yes, this is the way the work moves, or this is the – and, you know, we talk a lot about – with three-dimensional works, of course, you need to talk a lot about the way it responds to the environment. So we might talk about the way it's reflecting the light. So the environment becomes a part of the piece as well. So, you know, it's giving visitors as many different ways to look at and think about as possible.
John, you have a six-year-old at home.
Yes.
How do you all talk about the works of art that he's creating at this point in his life?
You know, oh my goodness, he's very good at describing what he does, and I can feel quite a bit. I've painted for so long that I can make very very light marks, so I'll feel and if he does his works in crayon, then I can feel that and the little marks.
Yeah.
And so I can find, and He's wonderful. It's interesting to me where if he's describing something for his mom or if he's showing, he'll say, "Hey, mom, look at this." But if it's me, "Hey, dad, feel this." You know, he knows it's different, and it seems like he's more descriptive. And he's amazing with art too, with abstract art. Oh my goodness, he can tell what's going on with the abstract. And a lot of times there's adults around and they don't have a clue what's in the painting, and he'll describe it and we'll read the description and he's right. It just blows my mind. I don't know where he gets it from.
You don't know where he gets it. So how do you decide what you want to paint?
It depends on feeling, really. And I almost everybody I paint and everything I paint are people from real life. Mm-hmm. So most of the people in my paintings, like 99%, are people that I've met or friends of mine. If you're a friend, then you may end up in a painting, whether you like it or not. You never know. you may just end up on the wall somewhere. And it's mostly what I can get hands on, and, mm-hmm. and a big part of that, of course, is I use touch to see, but it also makes a much stronger connection. You know, touch has a visceral connection with your emotions, and I'll tell you, you know, if you actually have your hands on somebody's face and you're mapping out their features, you're in their personal space.
It's so a really intimate act, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. You become friends really quick. You know, it's different than most artists who you may sit on the other side of a studio and you hardly talk and you're there for an hour and you leave. With me, it's a very much more personal sort of thing. And, but it makes the art better. The more of yourself you put into the art, then of course, the more you get out, and that forces you to really engage.
I'm guessing that touching faces was not something that you did when you were drawing and you could see. And I wonder what you learn about a person just feeling like how warm their cheeks are, or just the small details that our eyes don't pick up on, but our fingers do.
Oh my goodness, it's amazing. Even laugh lines or the way a person smiles, it's incredible. And your hands are so good at understanding contour and shape. The eyes are great at taking in lots of information, but it's not good at detail. With the hands, you get this instant sort of picture, and it's actually using art techniques that have been around for centuries that artists have used to break down compositions. Like if they're going to describe a competition to another artist, a composition, mm-hmm. They'll break it down in certain ways. So I'm using that to break down a person's face, but doing it through touch and being able to have it relate to other parts of the face, and it is just it's incredible in the colors that come from that. I've learned not to think about a painting too much before I actually meet the person and get my hands on them because the colors change. You know, their emotions, the way they feel, it can be radically different than what I had imagined.
Carmen, when you bring groups into the museum, and you mentioned that you have a program for people with early stage dementia, can you talk about how, in this case, people might have access to their senses, but maybe they're not able to communicate as effectively as before? Talk about the ways that you adjust the experience to really work well for them.
Well, we as much as possible, we want them to feel comfortable. I mean, creating a sense of comfort, and it's a very informal program. We convey to them all the time, this is an adult enrichment program, and it's as much for their care partner or their spouse or family member. So it is really just about, we use the same inclusive approaches. So in other words, it's not just targeted at the individual with a diagnosis, but to everyone in the group. So it is extremely, as I said, very interdisciplinary. We incorporate a lot of different things. And if we need to, we will change course immediately. Mm-hmm. So it's about being flexible. It's about reading your audience and seeing your audience, really understanding individual nuances. So, for example, if you're addressing the group and you notice that someone is approaching a little closer, maybe they can't see. If somebody's cocking their head or looks a little bit disengaged, maybe they can't hear. Mm-hmm. So it's about understanding the subtleties in your audience and just appreciating them for who they are and what their level of interest are. You know, a lot of times they're coming with a care partner, friend, or family member that is interested in art and they're looking for things to do.
Yeah.
And maybe they themselves are not that interested in art, haven't necessarily frequented art museums in the past. So it's really we're trying to be very creative in our teaching approaches and help them understand that the works are relevant to them, and we need to find ways to make those works relevant. So we have a great deal of fun, and in the same way that John was saying about our other programs, it is incredibly loose and comfortable, and we're starting to refer to it as Club Med because it's just so very relaxing. We look forward to the sessions. It is great, and we use those same approaches with our other programs as well.
Tell us about the session that you'll be leading on Saturday, John.
Oh my goodness, I'm going to be doing some art demonstrations and I'm available for any sort of questions. And I work with kids a lot, so people can ask me anything they want. kids will ask you anything. Hey, Mr. John, how do you go to the bathroom since you're blind? Or
apparently, you and astronauts get asked that question all the time.
So people can ask me anything. But I'll be showing how I paint. I'll be doing a live painting. And
is that nerve wracking?
I'm sorry?
Is that nerve-wracking to be painting?
No, actually, it's funny. If I'm doing a demonstration up on a stage or if I have a brush in my hand, I usually feel I'm very relaxed. I feel at home. But and it's actually a lot of fun because I love to connect with people over art, and the questions that I get, I learn so much from people coming over, and they're asking about, hey, why is it you do it like this, or what about this, or I have a friend that's into art, and this is what they told me, and it's just it's always so much fun, and I'll be demonstrating the techniques that I'm doing, and I'm always trying to come up with new techniques, so I've come up with some new ways of that I'm going to be trying out on Saturday, and just always trying to push the envelope a little bit, but so we'll see.
How do you divide your sort of time and energy between working in the studio and teaching and being a dad and all the other stuff you have going on?
Well, being a dad, of course, comes first, and my wife, obviously, bless her heart, she's amazing. But art, without art, I literally start losing my mind. I have to paint every day. I don't know. It's my way. For a lot of artists, art is expression. It's their way of talking to the world. For me, it's also my way of seeing the world, of understanding what's around me. So for me not to paint for one day, it's like a person who's sighted wearing a blindfold. So I have a lot of traveled art kits. So, you know, no matter where I'm going or how light I'm traveling.
Fit in your carry-on.
I do. I've got tiny ones and big ones and very heavy. And just camping, it doesn't matter. I've got art kits.
Really? That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Even a kayak. I've painted it on a kayak. Because after a painting, a workshop that we did, I thought, oh, that looks like fun. But, yeah, it's just, you know, honestly, for the different talks and the teaching and things, that for me, it's like the whipped cream on it. It's, you know, it's my ability, it's being able to get out there and actually talk to people. And that's why I got into artwork. Whenever I first started painting, I never thought anybody would ever see a painting of mine. It never crossed my mind that I would ever show a painting, that it would ever be listed on a website or anything, you know, and it was just my way of dealing with what I was going through. Mm-hmm. And it's continued to be that. But then I've been blessed, though, with this ability to go out and talk to people about something that I love. And I just can't tell you what that means to me. It's such a blessing. So whenever I get to go and work with a museum like the Meadows Museum, which is amazing, or a nonprofit or a charity, it's wonderful. It's hard to explain.
Carmen, can you talk about technology and the ways that people are sort of finding better ways to enhance museum experiences for anybody who might come in?
Yeah, that is something, of course, you know, we've had such incredible advances in technology and our abilities. You can go to museums now and they have interactive kiosks, or they might have the audio guides, that kind of thing. And we are, in fact, looking at trying to develop an app or something where someone that comes in independently that wants to be able to have the same kind of opportunities to explore works of art through many different contexts, mm-hmm. Might be able to do so. So, for example, if they were to click on, say, an image or a high-res image of a work from our permanent collection, it might offer them links to various different ways to approach it. And so we, too, are exploring that. But at this time, we've found the wonderful benefits of one-on-one and dialogue mm-hmm. and conversation, and how important the social setting of the art museum is to one's understanding and appreciation of a work of art. So we're really trying to capitalize on that first and foremost, and we don't ever want that to go away. And the Meadows Museum is relatively small when one compares it to some of the larger public museums. And so we feel particularly well equipped to create or to promote a more intimate experience for the visitor. So when they come in and they ask for a sighted guide, by golly, we better have a sighted guy on hand. and we do on Thursday nights. Actually, we're working with some Delta Gammas. Their philanthropy is working with blind and low vision. Mm-hmm. And so we have some students at SMU that will be there Thursday evenings to serve as sighted guides. And Thursday evenings, incidentally, we're open free from 5 to 9. So it's a great opportunity to try us out if you've never been there, and to visit with some of the Delta Gammas. And they'll introduce the works of art. They'll do description. They'll give them, again, the multisensory experience if one wants it. I think what's most important to convey is that we're affording people a menu of options, mm-hmm. and it's not about a one-size-fits-all. So it's not everybody will have a multisensory experience, everyone will have an interdisciplinary, but it's giving everybody these choices, and then they can sort of customize their visit as it's appropriate and relevant.
Carmen Smith is Director of Education at the Meadows Museum. Artist John Bramblett will present demonstrations of his painting by touch techniques this Saturday when the Meadows holds a family day event. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.